Well, those aren't honeybees you're hearing. That's the flight of the bumblebee, but kind of gets us in the mood, I think, for our first topic here today on Wisconsin Public Radio on the Larry Mueller Show. Getting inside to look at the world of honeybees with our guest today, Chelsea Cook. She is an assistant professor of biological sciences at Marquette University. Her lab studies animal behavior, and they're looking at honeybees to see how they organize in order to survive. Lots of really interesting things that they have found, and I know you're going to enjoy this. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Are you a beekeeper, maybe? Have you seen your bees organize or communicate to survive? Other questions relating to bees and honey, give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Chelsea Cook, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Larry. It's a pleasure.
So, you know, you're a professor of biological sciences. You could study a lot of things. Why did you choose to look at bees specifically?
That's a great question. You're exactly right. So I am generally interested in how organisms work together to do things that they could never do on their own. So you're exactly right. You can do this studying bacteria. You could do this studying forests. And I landed on bees when I was in undergrad. I read The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins and became absolutely fascinated with their social behavior. And he uses bees several times in his book to provide examples of how animals work together and in ways that you wouldn't expect. And I just became fascinated by them. So I knew I had to study them.
So somebody might say, well, why that? What's the difference? Why do we need to be concerned about the social aspects of a honeybee?
Absolutely. So when we study the social aspects of any organisms, we learn more about ourselves. Humans are also very social. We like to think sometimes we do everything on our own, but we take a look around. We live and work in buildings that are built by others, and we drive on roads that are built by others. So our lives are really facilitated by living in societies. And so honeybees also live in these complex societies where they build structures, they feed each other, they collect food. We know that very well. Obviously, they collect honey, which we love to eat ourselves. So when we can study social animals, we learn more about how our own societies are organized.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. You know, I watched a little video the other day of honeybees collecting from a sunflower plant. And I was just kind of amazed at the structure of the honeybee itself. And I learned a couple things watching that because there's a nice description of how they're made up. What is a honeybee made up of? What does it look like and made up of?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I love that you watched that video. So yeah, honeybees are so specialized as being these pollinators. So honeybees are insects. They have the basic structure of insects. They have six legs. They have two sets of wings. So they actually have four wings, but they are not independent, like dragonflies, for example. They have a head, thorax, and abdomen. They have antennae. I mentioned their legs. So as you're watching animals like bees, especially honeybees, pollinate, some honeybees have specialized hairs on their legs that actually help them keep pollen in place. So they look like they're almost wearing like chaps or something. They have just like these big old fluffy legs when they're collecting pollen, and they'll lick the pollen. So they'll, you know, put a little sticky spit on the pollen and pack their legs in. And so when we're For example, watching the entrance of the colony, we can see these bees flying in with these big bright orange or bright yellow, sometimes purple and white, just this, these rainbows of colors of pollen coming in from different flowers. They can smell and learn, so their antennae are their odor detecting apparatuses, just like our nose. And so they can smell flowers, they can learn flowers, they can smell where other bees have been and go to those same flowers. When I was doing a postdoc, I studied how bees learn and communicate to each other and how that drives colony level dynamics of where they end up going and foraging. So honeybees are absolutely remarkable, absolutely.
I was interested, I read somewhere that they carry... when they're kind of full and they're going back to the hive, they might have 35%, I think, of their body weight?
Oh, that's a really great question. I don't know the exact number, but that sounds correct and not surprising. They will gorge themselves. And there's some pretty interesting studies on honeybees and bumblebees and how they assess how much food they're carrying. So In solitary animals, if they have to go farther, there's a theory called optimal foraging theory. So if they have to go farther, they'll carry less weight, for example. We don't always see similar patterns in bees. So if bumblebees have to go farther, they will carry the same weight, but that actually stresses them out more and they live less, they live shorter lives because of that. And that just indicates that they kind of think about their societies and collecting food for others more than they think about, not that they're actually thinking about this, but evolution has selected them to value what they're doing for their society more than themselves as the individual. So you don't see this trade-off. The bees will continue working themselves pretty hard and they'll die sooner as a result of that because they're collecting food for their society, not just for themselves.
I'm doing the percentages on my own weight. If I had to carry an extra 70 pounds around,
that's a lot.
How many trips back and forth? Is it just one trip to the hive or is it?
It's that probably thousands. They are the foragers. They go back and forth. Once they become foragers, the bees work their butts off. They're back and forth all day long. And they also have different strategies, which is kind of cool. You'll have the exploiter bees that will go back and forth to the same food over and over and over again. So they're hyper-focused. They smell the same flower. They're happy to go back and forth. So it's just like going to your favorite restaurant. You're happy to eat there every day of the week. You love ordering the same thing. And then there's other bees that are more the explorer bees. So they visit a bunch of different flowers and they come back and they tell their colony about those new places. So they're the experimental, they're the ones who are going in to the new restaurant who's just opened up. They'll take a risk.
I'm somewhere in the middle on that.
Me too. So that's the beauty in a society like a honeybee society. You have some individuals that are the focused ones, some individuals that are the ones who are willing to take a risk, and then the colony as a whole meets somewhere in the middle. So they're averaged because of all the individuals inside of their colony having that kind of these extreme characteristics.
So they need to be around other bees.
Yes.
Honeybees need to be together. I saw something.
Honeybees do, yes.
I saw some research, or maybe it was you pointing out in a written piece, that if researchers have put honeybees alone, giving them all the food and drink they need, but they die much more quickly than
right.
Yeah, so you need the collective, I guess.
Absolutely.
You could say. And it's called collective. They do a lot of collective things, like collective fanning, for example. What does that really mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, and you're exactly right, Larry. So, like, we find we'll bring bees in to do like behavioral experiments on them, and some of them require them being alone. And you do end up getting bees who get super stressed just being by themselves. And we can dramatically reduce their stress by just placing them close together so that they can like see each other or smell each other. And it's pretty remarkable. So yeah, so you brought up fanning, and this is the main collective behavior that my lab studies. Fanning is a behavior that is exactly what it sounds. So the bees literally flap their wings, and this circulates air and cools the colony down, among other tasks that this behavior accomplishes. So part of this is cooling the colony down. They also will regulate carbon dioxide and humidity inside the colony. They'll fan to dry the honey. So when they collect nectar from flowers, it's really wet. It has a high water content, and they'll actually fan on top of the honeycomb to reduce the water content of nectar, and that concentrates it down into that sweet honey that we know and love. But we mostly study fanning for temperature regulation. And just like our bodies, honeybee colonies need to regulate temperature to ensure that everybody is healthy inside the colony. If the colony gets too hot, the developing baby bees inside can actually develop malformations. They can have impacts on their learning later in life. And if it gets very hot, then the colony can, the baby bees inside the colony can die. So it's a really critical behavior, temperature regulation. It really just a few degrees above, they regulate to about 96 degrees Fahrenheit. So just a few degrees cooler than we regulate our bodies. And if it gets a little too warm, even just by a couple of degrees, then the developing baby bees inside can suffer.
It's amazing to me how they can be so precise.
Oh, it's incredible.
In judging, and you wonder how they do it. I mean, is it how they feel, or what? You know, what's in them that can make it so precise for their hive?
Yeah, Larry, you are touching exactly on what our questions, our main questions are, and surprisingly, not a ton of work on this. So we are trying to identify the components that drive this fanning behavior. And what when I was a PhD student, what I found was if I collected a bee who was actively fanning at the entrance of her colony and brought her into the lab and heated her up inside the lab, she didn't fan. And she was just fanning 30 minutes before, and if I heated her up, she didn't fan. And to me, I was disappointed. I was, you know, a first year PhD student. I was trying to figure out how to run these experiments. And I was like, oh God, am I ever going to be a scientist? And I was like, well, wait a second. I guess they're always, you know, so I ran 50 to 100 of these assays, heating these bees up, seeing if they would fan. And I rarely got an individual isolated bee to fan. And then I realized, like, when I'm out at the colony watching these animals, they're almost always fanning as a group. There's more than one at the entrance of the colony. So the next experiment I did, I was like, let me just grab two. So I stuck two inside, brought them inside, heated them up, and they both fanned. And so I was like, it was that first inclination that it was a collective behavior, that it was social, and it wasn't just them experiencing hot temperatures, but also needing to be in a group. And so that has set me off on this path. So I was, you know, that was me doing my PhD in 2011. And now it's, you know, 2026. So 15 years later, I have my research lab. I have PhD students asking, you know, these questions and trying to dive in. And it turns out it's pretty complicated. So this is why it's taken, you know, several years to figure this out.
Oh, man. Chelsea Cook, our guest today, assistant professor of biological sciences at Marquette University. It's great to have her with us. today to talk about bees. Interesting stuff. If you have a question or comment, maybe you've got an experience with bees you want to share, give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about honeybees today and collective behavior among honeybees with our guest, Chelsea Cook, Assistant Professor of Biological Sciences at Marquette University. Questions, comment, give a call, the number 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. So another behavior I think you look at is foraging, and honeybees forage for pollen, of course, but what else? They forage for other things as well.
Yeah, they do. So they forage for pollen, and pollen is their protein and fat source mostly. They forage for nectar. So flowers give off these sweet rewards to keep the bees coming back to them. And they forage for nectar as their carbohydrate source. So lots of sugar in nectar. And that's what they collect to turn into honey. So honey is just concentrated nectar from flowers. Surprisingly, bees will also collect a couple of different substances from the environment. They'll collect water to regulate the temperature in their colony. So this also goes hand in hand with the fanning behavior. So bees act as their own swamp coolers. I lived in Arizona. I grew up in New York, in Western New York, very similar to lots of Wisconsin weather. But when I lived in Phoenix, one of the main sources of temperature regulation in buildings and houses are swamp coolers. So they use evaporative cooling to cool homes instead of using coolant and everything. They're just using water and airflow. So honeybees do this exact same thing. They'll go and collect water. They'll bring it inside their colony, and they literally spit it up. So by collecting water, they use their tongue. They suck it up like a straw, and then they hold it. They have a special stomach that they use to hold on to water or nectar. They'll come back to their colony. They spit it up. They literally spit it onto their honeycomb, and then them or other bees will come by and fan, and this creates some evaporation effect that cools the colony down as well. So this is really nice in the summertime, especially when it's not super humid in Wisconsin, but that does happen quite a bit during the summer. Bees will also forage for tree sap, and they will collect, especially in the summer when the sap is running, that sticky, gooey sap from trees, they will collect that the same way that they collect pollen. So they'll put it on their legs, and they turn this into a substance called propolis. So they mix some sap with wax, and this is essentially like mortar. So inside their colony, they do not like gaps. They do not like light coming in. So anywhere there's a gap or anywhere things need to be filled in, they'll use propolis to smear and seal up any gaps or any cracks inside their colony with propolis. So yeah, bees are pretty remarkable, aren't they?
They are indeed. And aren't there some that are assigned, you're the water guy, more or less?
Yes, exactly. So yep, the very rarely do you see bees collect multiple things. If you are the pollen forager, you're the pollen forager, and if you're the sap forager, you're the sap forager, and they very rarely switch. There's so many fascinating ways that animals divide labor, and this is kind of the question that a lot of scientists like myself who study social insects ask is, how do they do this? How do they know? Larry, how do you know you're the radio host, and how do I know I'm the scientist, right? How do we divide labor? We both do important jobs. How do we do it? How do we know? And that's exactly the same question that we're asking in honeybees. I will also say all worker honeybees are girls, so they're gals and not guys.
So the gals do all the work.
That's right.
What do the guys do?
The guys do the very important job of passing on genes, so they mate with the queen. Other than that, they don't do a whole lot. So they're even too big to sometimes feed themselves if they can't. The males, that we call them drones, way before drones were like the flying robots that we have, drone honeybees do the very important job of mating. If they're inside the colony before they go out on their mating flights to find the queen and mate with her, they're sometimes too big to even stick their heads into honeycomb to eat, and so they'll beg the workers, the gals inside the colony, for food. So they're pretty, they do a very important job, but they're cute, delicate little babes.
Oh man, well, it sounds like good work if you can get it.
Honestly, it's not a bad life. It's not a bad, just being taken care of, getting the spa treatment, and then you get to try to mate. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Oh man, that's a pretty good deal. Asa in Green Bay, we won't go any further with that. Asa in Green Bay, it's your turn with a comment or question. Asa, go ahead.
Hi, Larry. I know this isn't garden talk, but I figured she would still be a pretty good person to ask. Does she have any recommendations for how to make your yard as bee-friendly as possible? Do they care if plants are native? Do they have a color preference? Is it variety or pollen output?
Yeah. I think you're pretty good at answering that one, Chelsea.
Yeah, that's a great question, Asa. The number one recommendation I have is use as few chemicals in your yard as possible. So I live here in Milwaukee, and my favorite thing to do in the spring and summer is just go out and put some elbow grease in my garden and pull some weeds. So I try to avoid any use of chemicals. So no herbicides, no pesticides. Even if they don't kill bees or kill other pollinators, a lot of the sublethal effects do have impacts on how they learn, how they regulate temperature in their colonies. So that's the number one component that I recommend. The second is for honeybees in particular. Honeybees are generalist bees, which means they will forage on pretty much anything. They evolved in Europe. So European flowers, like a lot of clover, like Dutch clover, the honeybees love. Other bee species that are native to the Americas, like a lot of bumblebee species and native bee species to Wisconsin, evolved on flowers that also evolved here. So a lot of nightshades, for example. So any tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, peppers are all in the nightshade family, as well as a lot of wild nightshades, especially here in Wisconsin. Those vines that go everywhere in the summer, the bumblebees and native bees absolutely love them. And they are, they have specialized ways to get the pollen and forage for the pollen that honeybees actually cannot do. So I love kind of supporting a mix of bees in my yard, both honeybees and native pollinators like bumblebees and other bees like sweat bees or squash bees. One final thing is letting some of your yard be a little wild. So a lot of solitary bees, native bees to Wisconsin, as well as bumblebees. The bumblebee queens will overwinter in leaf litter. Some other bee species will overwinter in twigs or in strands of dried grass. And so if you can leave parts of your yard wild, leave some piles of leaves, leave sticks, leave some grass, old grasses that have gone to seed, and they'll feed the birds, but they will also provide some housing and overwintering for a lot of the native bee species here in Wisconsin. So excellent question. Hopefully gave you a nice three-pronged approach to making your yard a little bit bee-friendly.
Yeah, thanks, Asa. Great question. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. You could email the talk at WPR.org. Vern in Boyd says bees have iron in them to help them navigate using the Earth's magnetic field.
Yes, they do.
Is that correct? It is, from the sound of it.
It is. Absolutely. Yep. So bees have iron deposits in their cells. We do as well. Many animal species that are very good at navigation, like homing pigeons, there is some evidence that they also have iron and other metals in their cells that send signals to their brain that help them orient. So bees are among those animals that have metal in their cells that help them do that. Bees can also see polarized light. And so if you have polarized sunglasses, you can kind of see this in the sky. There are areas of dark stripes and areas of light stripes when you're wearing your polarized sunglasses, and bees can see that as well. And so with their eyes, obviously, and that helps them navigate. So bees can use polarized light to navigate and know which direction they're going. Another amazing reason to study other animals, and especially how animals use these different sensory mechanisms to navigate their world, which is totally different than what we see and experience every day.
You know, I was thinking about the other bees other than honeybees as you were talking. I'm thinking, you know, there's solitary bees. Are there bees that have a social structure that might, Wisconsin bees, let's say, that might have a social structure similar to honeybees?
That's such a great question, Larry. Yes, bumblebees. So there are several bumblebee species in Wisconsin. I don't know the exact number, but definitely a couple dozen bumblebee species, including the rusty patch bumblebee, which is an endangered bumblebee species in Wisconsin. And you're exactly right. They have they are more social, so they're not as extremely social as the honeybees. One different characteristic in a bumblebee society is that they don't get as big. So honeybee societies can grow to be sometimes, you know, between 30,000 and 50,000 individuals at their peak population in the summer, where bumblebees tend to only get a couple dozen worker bees inside the colony. But they do have a very similar structure, as in honeybee colonies and bumblebee colonies only have one queen. They have one reproductive individual that lays all the eggs of all the workers inside the colony. So that is similar. And then in the winter, honeybee colonies will overwinter with a pretty high population. They keep the queen inside a cluster, and they shiver and keep warm all winter long. So that's essentially what our honeybees are doing out today, is shivering, clustering, and keeping warm all winter long. And then when spring hits, when it finally hits, which is whenever it feels like it here in Wisconsin between April and June, then they kind of pick up where they left off the fall before. Bumblebees do something a little bit different. In the fall, they will produce more queens. The colony itself will die, and one queen will go out, and they also produce male bees or drones. The drones will mate with a queen. The queen will overwinter in leaf litter, just like I was mentioning, or underground, or sometimes inside your house. And she will overwinter, and then she starts a brand new colony the next year. So they have a slightly different reproductive schedule, and then only one queen survives overwinter, and then she starts a brand new colony in the spring, which is just absolutely fascinating.
It is indeed. Listener call couldn't stay with us. Why do you see bees swarming outside of their nest?
Oh, that is such a good question. So we almost think of honeybee colonies as an organism in and of itself. So a term was coined probably 1940s, 1950s, called the superorganism. So we almost view the colony itself as an individual, as a superorganism, which means if you think about the workers as equivalent as like our skin cells, our stomach cells, our digestion, our brain. So the workers are doing the job of all the cells in our body and cooperating with each other. And then you have the reproductive cells like our ovaries and testes and the eggs and sperm that they produce. So you can think of the queen and the drones as equivalent to those kinds of cells. And so at a colony level, they reproduce. So you have the queen laying all the workers and all the eggs and reproducing herself, but then the colony itself also reproduces, and this is swarming. So it's essentially, a swarm is essentially a bud of the colony. They will produce a new queen. The new queen actually inherits the colony, and the old queen, because she's experienced and she's a little bit older, goes off with about a third of the workers in the colony, and they don't know where they're going yet. They'll actually go, and we often find them on branches of trees, usually for just a day, maybe two, before they go and find their new colony. A great book called Honeybee Democracy by Tom Seeley, who's a professor at Cornell for many decades, and he has part of his research was exploring how bees actually find their new nest and vote using a dance, the waggle dance. And so excellent book about how honeybees make those choices. But that's essentially what swarming is the colony level reproduction. So the colony as a whole reproduces. And that is what we see oftentimes in May and June here in Wisconsin.
It's pretty cool, and that waggle dance is interesting. And how that's one way they communicate. And is it the flapping of their wings? I think I've read, what is it about? They can flap their wings about 11,000 times a minute or something like that.
That sounds about right. Yep, it is so fast and absolutely incredible. And the way that they're, my husband's actually a fluid dynamicist. He's a engineer, and so we have had pretty nerdy conversations about wings, and it's pretty remarkable because they're so small. They're actually like swimming through the air, so the wings just don't go up and down like flapping. They actually like do figure eights, and they like move the air in much more efficient ways than what humans have ever created in terms of engineered flying objects. So yeah, so they move real fast.
But don't they regulate in order to communicate different things, don't they regulate the pace of which that happens?
That's a great question. Yes, they do. So when they're flying, they're moving their wings much faster and performing more beats per second compared to when they're doing like the fanning behavior at the entrance of their colony. They will throttle the you know, number of beats per second because they don't want to take off, right? They want to move air, but their aim isn't to actually take off and fly. So they do throttle that movement. I think something we know very little about is how they throttle that. What are the, like, how do their muscles know to work at 50% versus 100%? Again, some of these physiological, these cool physiological questions that we can ask in animals like bees. They also will fan to communicate. So honeybees, in addition to the waggle dance, they use chemicals called pheromones to communicate. And sometimes they will use fanning to spread pheromones more widely. So they'll release a pheromone from a gland and then fan their wings to also spread that pheromone even more widely. And again, they're not flapping as hard as they would be if they were flying because they just want to spread that pheromone. So
yeah.
Definitely a couple of different mechanisms there.
I'm trying to draw out of my memory. It seems to me that beekeepers can tell how a colony is feeling by the tone of the flapping of the wings, because that's what's creating that buzz sound. And if you hear this, the tone go up higher, that is a signal that the colony's under some distress or they're worried.
Yes, that's exactly right. So those of us who have been beekeeping for years definitely can tune into the sounds your colonies make. And so, for example, yep, if I am doing inspections and I open up a colony and they're really buzzy and they're, you know, they're high pitched, they just seem loud. They seem loud. They seem high pitched. My first instinct is, I wonder if the queen is still in here, or if she's doing okay, because it's usually a part of their distress signaling is the queen here, and that's definitely a stressful event if the colony can tell the queen isn't there. So then it immediately puts me on edge of like, okay, I need to find the queen inside this colony and make sure everything is looking okay. There are even some startup companies that have tried to tap into putting like sound sensors inside colonies to see if they can translate that frequency into an alert that can alert beekeepers to something that might be going on in their colony. And I'm not sure anyone has been super successful with that yet, because it is subtle. It's definitely an interesting way an interesting approach, because yeah, it's so prevalent when beekeepers know something's going on.
Boy. Chelsea Cook, our guest, and Mary from Lebanon has a comment or question. Let's go there. Mary, hi.
I have a comment. I live in a one day I was walking up the drive. I live on a dead-end road, and I have lots of native plants around here. I had a bee swarming in a bush.
In a bush?
Why? Yeah, and it was really... And anyway, so yeah, I watched them. And so then I called a friend, Mr. Nas, who had bees, and he had them here a number of years ago. And so then he said, suggested I call somebody else, and nobody was available. So then he came the next day and brought a hive and put it on the ground for them to go to. And then he took them all home with him.
Absolutely. We have caught our own a fair number of swarms around campus. Luckily, it happens after students are gone, so it doesn't freak out too many people. But we've done the same thing. You can put what we've done in the past is just put an empty box underneath if you see the swarm, and you can shake the swarm from a bush or from a tree branch into the box. Some folks also have modified shop vacs, and you can put a bag in instead of having it go into the canister of the shop vac. You can put a bag at the end and suck up, since shop vacs are pretty open, they don't have a ton of filtration unless you have them, you know, have it filtered. You can modify a shop vac to be a bee vac, and then you can vacuum up bees in a swarm, and then they can go directly into a bag or a box, like a ventilated bag. And yeah, so that's great that your beekeeping friend was able to get a free swarm that day, get a free colony that day.
Mary, great. Thanks for that story, Mary. Appreciate it very much. Chelsea Cook, our guest today, professor of biological sciences at Marquette University. Questions for her, give a call at 800-642-1234. You could email the talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at the top of the hour, we'll be talking with our weather guys about climate and weather and fall springs, things like that. Right now, taking a look at bees with our guest, Chelsea Cook, assistant professor of biological sciences at Marquette University. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email the talk at WPR.org. Tom in Madison has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how you doing? Say, I just have been I'm a beekeeper wannabe, and I want to get a natural beekeeping. And I'm reading a book called Keeping Bees with a Smile, which is very interesting. I just thought you might comment on that book.
Keeping Bees with a Smile?
Right.
Okay. The author is?
I'm trying to remember what the author is. I don't have it right in front of me right now.
Well, if there's only one book with the title Keeping Bees with a Smile, Chelsea, You familiar with that book?
I am not familiar with that book. You know, beekeeping definitely brings a smile to my face most of the time, but sometimes I get stung and it's not, I'm not smiling when that happens, but I think that, so I just did a quick search of it. It looks like the author is Fedor Lazutin. I love any books that help us learn more about beekeeping and everyone's, you know, different takes and different approaches. I think there's a balance. So, you know, in beekeeping, especially in the last 20 to 25 years, honeybees have been dealing with many new diseases, many new parasites. So for example, enemy number one for us beekeepers is the Varroa mite, Varroa destructor. This is a parasitic mite that that gets inside the colonies and they feed on the developing baby bees, the larvae inside the colony, and can, as they feed on them, they bite them and they can spread viruses when they do that, and that can really impact the health of your colonies. So there's definitely a balance to be struck, and depending on where this beekeeper who wrote this book is, in some areas of the world, these mites aren't as bad, and so they don't have to worry about them. Here in Wisconsin, our number one goal is to try to ensure our bees survive winter. And if they are infested with these mites, it is almost guaranteed that they will not survive winter. So we take them very seriously. We use highly concentrated chemicals, for lack of a better word, even though many of them are natural chemicals. So for example, we use oxalic acid and a compound called thymol, which is concentrated thyme oil. But these are pretty intense chemicals. So when we use oxalic acid, we need a respirator, pretty intense PPE to do this, because we vaporize the acid. And this is how we approach Varroa mites. So I equate it to making sure your dogs and cats are treated for fleas and ticks. Just like they can spread diseases to our animals and to ourselves, we take it very seriously. I'm all for accumulating as many resources and picking what's best for you. Reading books is awesome. Also finding a mentor or taking a class. I know the University of Wisconsin Extension Program has a 16-week beekeeping class that helps you learn pretty much everything you need to know about beekeeping, especially here in Wisconsin. And there's many of YouTube videos. So if you want to be a beekeeper, doing the education and finding out what it's like, finding a mentor, getting in those colonies, I love that approach. That's great.
And, you know, you mentioned in part of your comment there overwintering, and you are co-founder of a company. It's called Hive Tech, H-I-V-E, Tech, Solutions, where you're working on methods for overwintering bees. It's pretty interesting stuff. I looked at your site online, and it's pretty cool. Talk about it.
That's right. Yeah, so we had been working for over a decade trying to develop tools for beekeepers to help them keep bees more effectively. A lot of tools, like I was mentioning, these sensors help beekeepers kind of tune into their colonies maybe a little bit more effectively, but not many tools were actually providing an actual method to improve their beekeeping. And we know from the evolution of honeybees that they evolved having pretty intense winters or pretty intense periods where they could not go collect food. And so we wanted to give them a more stable environment to overwinter in. This winter is a great example. It was very cold through December and January. And then a couple weeks ago, it got a little warm and our bees were out flying. And that can really disrupt the stability of the colony, especially when it goes from being really cold to really warm one day, and then the next day it's back to being below freezing. So it can stress colonies out. So we had been working on that. The tariffs definitely disrupted our business flow. So we were making them, these units, inside in the United States. And then our beekeepers and our farmers, who definitely, live well within their means, were asking us for a cheaper product. So in December of 2024, we moved production to China. And then we all know what happened in January of 2025. So it's been a struggle, definitely trying to figure out what, with the impact of tariffs, how that process was going to keep going, because these are big pods. These are big refrigerated pod units, essentially. So aluminum structure, insulation, sensors, things like that, that we were doing. But yeah, it was a great project, and really got a lot of positive feedback from beekeepers who were using this. We had a lot of success, and a lot of really good survival over winter.
Yeah, it sounds great. My daughter, Emily, is marrying the son of a family that has Gentle Breeze Honey,
awesome,
and out of Mount Horeb, and they send their honeybees to California, I think, in the winter.
Exactly. So, yep, a lot of beekeepers. So, and there's this sweet spot. So, in between the kind of hobby beekeeper who has like one or two colonies in their backyard, those who do well, and like we were talking about swarming, you can actually grow your operation if you're a good beekeeper and pretty successful. Sometimes your operation can grow pretty fast, so there is that sweet spot. Some folks who do run more colonies have the ability to kind of truck them or send them in truckloads to warmer areas to overwinter in more pleasant areas like California or Texas.
Michael emailed, do drones and queens from the same colony mate with each other? If they do, that's an inbreeding problem, you'd think.
That's a great question. Yes, it would be an inbreeding problem. They do not. I mean, there's not. When the queen goes to mate with drones, they do mating flights. So they actually leave the colony to do their mating process. So that does increase the probability that you mate with someone who is not your son, as it were, inside the colony. So there's that mechanism is a really good mechanism to make sure that you are. Definitely, there's less of a chance of inbreeding, but there is a chance. I mean, even in,
sure,
big old mating flights, that might happen, but it's definitely reduced. So yeah, so the queens and drones leave the colony and do mating flights for mating.
In the
great question.
Yeah, in the last 40 seconds or so, beekeeping can at times be frustrating, as you're sort of indicating here. What's your advice for beginners for finding peace while working with bees?
That's a great question. I think find the folks around you, a good beekeeping community. There's tons of amazing bee clubs and courses around Wisconsin that can be a source of peace and knowledge that can help improve your chances as a beekeeper.
Well, peace be with you, Chelsea, and
and also with you, Larry.
Thanks so much. Let's do this again down the road. I love talking with you. Thank you.
I'd love that. What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Chelsea Cook, an assistant professor of biological sciences at Marquette University. I learned some things, and I bet you did as well. And coming up, I think we'll all learn some things about climate and weather, because our weather guys, John Martin, Steve Ackerman, joining us next. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller as we buzz out here on the talk at WPR.org. We'll be right back.